You're listening to TASH Amplified, a podcast that seeks to transform research and experience concerning inclusion and equity for people with disabilities into solutions people can use in their everyday lives. Today we're talking with Lyle Rahmer, who recently retired as Executive Director of the Seattle Area Community Living Agency Total Living Concept. We'll reflect on his 42 years of experience providing person-centered support to people with disabilities and the future of community living under the Medicaid Home and Community-Based Services Waiver. Lyle served as president of the TASH Board of Directors from 2007 to 2008. Lyle Rahmer, please introduce yourself for our listeners.
Sure. Hi, Donald. Nice to be with you today. I've recently retired from my active work in the field of supporting people with developmental and intellectual disabilities. But I guess the quickest way to summarize my career over the past 30 or so years is I was a senior research associate at both the University of Washington and for a period of time, the University of Oregon. And I primarily coordinated federally funded research projects in supporting folks with developmental disabilities in inclusive classrooms and inclusive community opportunities. I also spent a good deal of time as the representative of the Developmental Disabilities Administration to the University of Washington's School of Public Health and Community Medicine for a number of years, in which I managed research projects that were of interest to the state that were conducted at the Center for Disability Policy and Research. And for the 14 years prior to my retirement, I served as executive director of a supported living agency just south of Seattle called Total Living Concept. And in those 14 years, I also found time to be on the TASH board for 6 years and serve as president for three. And that's a kind of a quick shot of who I am and what I've been doing for the last 30 or so years.
Going from academia to a support agency is an unusual career change. How did you do that?
Well, I don't know how unusual. It was pretty logical for me. Working for academia, I of course, gained really useful and functional skills in many areas. Actually working for the state and managing research projects caused me to spend a lot more time thinking about what would it be like if I was actually doing the things that I was trying to teach others to do. And I thought that would, enhance my ability to maybe understand what it took to create more opportunities for more people to have person-centered supports for a life that they wanted to live. So rather than teaching others how to do it, I decided to go do it myself for about 14 years. And I think it worked out reasonably well.
Tell us about the model of person-centered planning that has guided you in your career.
Well, I'm going to answer that probably a little unconventionally. As we all know, there are many different processes that share a common denominator of being person-centered planning, things like PATH and MAPS and essential lifestyle planning, on and on. There are numerous different labels that have been created over the years. But actually what I follow and what I wanted to kind of point out to people is, and I don't think this is certainly very respectful of the work of people who brought person-centered planning to larger and wider audiences in the late 70s, early 80s, primarily John O'Brien and Connie Lyle O'Brien and Beth Mount. But I think people do person-centered planning, whether they're calling it such or not. And I think both myself and more so my wife, Mary, just did person-centered planning without knowing it had a name. And I think when you take a look at the core values and core commitments one makes in doing person-centered planning, you can see those are core values and commitments you make in any respectful relationship where one person is seeking help and another person is saying, I'd like to be the source of some of that help for you. How can I do it best? And I think when you reduce it to that, you find that you were doing person-centered planning before you became aware of it. And I think the key in that finding out that, wow, we were really doing something that other people have thought about too, was then the connections with those people that allowed it to grow beyond whatever it may have been and what it may have become. And I think when you encounter that community of practice of other people who share a good deal of your value base around how to support and how to offer support, then you get exposed to more things that have names and attached labels and so forth. But what you really find is the sharing relationships with other people who come together for the same reason. We're all trying to, in some way, as an active agent or a catalyst, create more opportunities for people to have lives that they find fulfilling and satisfying that are lived in the company of others. So I think it's a natural kind of thing. I think kind of have that inclination to person-centered, but when you then realize there are other people that do that, it really takes off and grows.
A lot of the adult services world is not person-centered planning oriented. How did you become oriented this way?
Well, again, it's a story of meeting people along the way that you could find a way to work with those people and take the, if you will, if I can put it so kind of in a pretty basic level, is that you take the side of the person seeking support. You ally yourself with that person. And person-centered planning, interestingly enough, when you, examine where it came from and examine, the work of the people I mentioned, John and Connie and Beth and many others as well, you find very quickly that person-centered planning is really a social change vehicle, if you will. It's not a process that you can, pull off a shelf like, okay, we have to have the ISP done or the IEP or the IHP or the ISP or the I blank, whatever P you're involved in. But person-centered planning takes a broader perspective of working with people. It's not just a planning process. It's a process that recognizes when one goes to the person and says, what do you want your life to look like? Not what does the state or the federal service system think your life's going to look like? What do you want it to look like? And when you ask that question and align yourself with people, your process then becomes one of changing systems that don't fit what is needed for a person to move closer and closer to that vision of their own life. So as such, it's always been, and nothing's changed as far as I can see, in the role of person-centered planning as a catalyst for change. Because Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, have put forth new rules that people have to have person-centered plans. That's great, I mean, I guess. But I don't see it fundamentally changing anything. There's still a need for social change. States still take positions that I think most of us would agree don't quite measure up to person-centered practices when it comes to individual people. So as such, the fact that people have to have a plan, well, that's okay, I guess, but it has to be considered distinct. The person-centered plan isn't state services. They're two vastly different things. The plan belongs to the person and it's theirs. It's not the state's. How it interfaces with the state's plan is an important question, and I think an area we're going to have a lot of learning needing to happen on both sides. How do we take this person-centered plan and mesh it more closely? How do we do this in a way that states begin to modify their relationship with people and let go of some of their paternal tendencies of the past to make decisions about how people's lives should look and what they should be doing as a result of services. So again, I still see this as person-centered planning as a social change process. And when we think of it that way, we, you know, again, hopefully move off of the setting where a plan is done and big pieces of paper on the wall. That's wonderful. As my friend Norm Kuntz and Emma Vandercliff say, what happens when the paper comes down is what really counts. And I agree. You're still aligning yourself with people and saying, I'm in your corner, and how do we find the resources that you need? And when those resources have barriers attached to them that don't work for you, how do we change those barriers? You know, I think we all learned a great deal from Judith Snow, who, as we know, recently passed on. And her, you know, her call to what that change means and how that fundamentally alters the relationships of people who seek to be supportive of people into one of providing that support under the direction of the person that forms that circle around. You're my allies, and here's how you can help. And I think that's exactly what person-centered planning is going to continue to be. I certainly hope so. My intent, as I continue my practice, to not change that direction.
What issues do you see emerging as the new home and community-based services rules are put in place?
Well, I guess I can answer that two ways, Donald. Is one, what I think will happen, what I hope would happen. Let's be more hopeful. I think at some point, what will happen is there will be opportunities to enter the dialogue around people create person-centered visions for their lives in which they're encouraged to think of their lives no differently than you or I or anyone thinks of their lives. What are the important things? And I'm sure we can broadly expect certain things to come out. People want to have homes of their own. People want to have meaningful activities, purpose in their lives. People want to have relationships with others that they cared deeply for and in return or cared about by those people in their lives. And as people pursue that vision, that opportunity for that vision that's provided in the person-centered process, and we begin to work towards that, I think the emerging point that we're going to have a lot of dialogue over is how still state service systems are aligned in developing policies and administrative rules that, upon first examination, do not seem to mesh well with a person-centered approach. A couple of examples, if I might. Many states, not just one or two, have some form of rule or policy that really discourages people from having truly homes of their own. They're still expected to live in groups. Granted, the groups are smaller than institutions of the past, but they're still groups. And the key in understanding what are still vestigial institutional practices are you make decisions for people. It's a power relationship. When you say people, you will live with two or three others that you don't have a choice of. That's still an institutional model. It may be in the community, but it's still clinging to an institutional approach. When you look at that, and I hope this is the kind of dialogue we'll get into, you quickly surmise this is a fiscally motivated process. People believe that it's less expensive or more altruistically. I could serve more people if you guys would live in a group. And I would put to challenge that notion. I think that's flawed thinking. I think when you look at what person-centered is, I believe, as I've been taught and learned how it works, is you don't go to the state and say, okay, here's my vision. Let's align all the services for me in this way. People who really approach person-centered and I think really get it, they start, it comes from the inside out, not the outside in. It starts with the person and their resources. It starts with their family and the resources that that family gives all its members in developing the life that they want. I think you draw allies to you. You have other supports in your community that are there, most of which have nothing to do with you having a disability. They may have to do with, you know, your income level. But you assess all of those and use all of those before you go to the state and say, now I need you to help fill in the gaps, not the other way around. When you do it that way, it is not more expensive to support people individually to live in homes of their own, have jobs that are meaningful and fulfilling, and have a wide range of relationships that are mutually caring. I think the fallacy comes from when you think, oh, everybody's going to live on their own, and everybody's going to just send a bill to the state for all the costs of living alone. It's no, that's not the way it works. And that's, again, a very historically, you know, it's kind of like a bush that's prickly and hard to eradicate. It's just something that's got started and it persists, and it does not have to be true. It is not true if you take a different approach to working with people and finding all the resources, not just the state dollar. So I think that's a big emerging issue. I think the other is, states are going to have to find a new way to develop policies and rules that can ensure that their dollars, they have every responsibility to ensure the dollars are spent wisely and effectively. It's public money, stewardship's important. But I think one of the ways that we've kind of got hung up and where it clashes with person-centered is when you make a decision from a great distance, as if some vast number of people who receive supported living, for instance, some 5,000 people, are all equal and alike, and you write a rule that applies to all equal and all alike. For instance, everybody shall have 3 rehabilitation goals at a minimum in their ISP, individual service plan. Well, I can guarantee that's not going to work for a certain number of people. Rehabilitation goals are not what people are interested in, per se. And it clings to the old thinking that somehow people are flawed, and if they have enough rehabilitation goals that are successful, they'll gain skills and they won't need as much support. And that also seems to be a fairly sketchy formula. So I think, you know, learning to invest and cultivate local decision making that enhances people's opportunities to again develop those relationships, live those lives that they find fulfilling, and really seriously begin to question the rulemaking that applies as if equal across vast numbers of people, when we know it just doesn't. I believe it works better when we invest in local decision making.
Is it possible to change the ethic of a large organization?
Mm-hmm.
If not, how do we incubate small support organizations?
Well, I think the answer is yes, and I think you can. And I don't think of it as help convert large or do something else. I think you do two things. I think you can help large organizations change and convert. I also think we've learned it's a long process, a slow process. It's a good thing to do. It's the right thing to do sometimes. But getting buy-in, getting commitment of all those involved often is disruptive. And, you know, people have to think about, do I want to hang in here and continue doing it, even though it's going to be different than what I've been doing, you know, for a long time. So I think, yes, you can do that. I believe efforts to do that are still well-founded. However, I also believe that just looking at converting large organizations is a strategic error in thinking. The other alternative is, I don't even think it's an alternative. I think it should be happening consecutively, is that you develop small, agile agencies that can adapt and start from day one with a commitment to person-centered work with people. We have, I know in numerous states, there are people waiting because state service, community services in agencies, the spots might be available, but for a variety of reasons, it's tough to get people into support in some of the agencies. Just the logistics of it, the challenge of hiring new staff. I think there's a lot of reasons that we can find a quicker path to opening some opportunities for people to do to receive person-centered supports when we go and say, let us begin, let us start 12 new agencies this year. Let us recruit, and I think the people are out there to be recruited into this agency that will begin its journey from the get-go with a deep understanding and commitment to person-centered principles. And I think you do both. I think you can convert the large, and I think you can. I spent a good number of years working for the University of Oregon in the state of Washington in the mid to end of the 80s, in which we began. I'd have to go back and count at least a dozen agencies across the state and taught them a new way. It wasn't necessarily person-centered strictly, but began all those new agencies, and they all started with 8, 10, 12 people, and many are still around now and are the large agencies that maybe need to be reoriented. But I think you do both, and I think the resources are there to do both.
So a lot of the way that support is structured has to do with the policies of state governments. Is there any opportunity in the near future for review or public input on these policies?
There's always a process for review and public input. As people are on waivers, they have rights of fair hearings and appeals and all of the due process is laid out. It's not always perfect. I wish it was a little closer to the model under the IDEA that governs education for folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities, where there are appointed fair hearing officers that are neutral from both the school system and the families and the students. And we don't necessarily see that in all the state structures for fair hearings and waivers. I think you're often still appealing through the state system, which I'm not accusing anyone of anything dastardly, but that's a biased system. You're still appealing, and the judge is part of the system that you're appealing about. So I think you're it would be nice if we had a little bit more independence in the hearing structure. But and CMS periodically is, certainly open to input from the field. I've always found the folks at CMS to be more than happy to get phone calls and emails about how things are working, what's working, what's not, how can they be changed and improved. So I think there's no scarcity of opportunities, I think, for input and for change. I think, again, I'd like to see the system a little bit more impartial for fair hearings as we get into this deeper and deeper. But I think, yes, it will come down to, and I think the federal position is they're not going to, put out a cookbook for states to follow, and that's good. They shouldn't. But I think we also have to monitor how states put their practices in front of people and say, this is what we can make available to you. And we know you have this person-centered plan now. And I think one of the things that I've seen very little of so far is a state that's honestly sat down and said, a couple have really apparently shown a real commitment to going through and looking at their whole system and say, how does this need to be changed? I think others have done very little serious review of their own policies, their own administrative rules and practices around how does this work as a person-centered approach to working with the people that we're responsible for. So I think there's a good deal of learning to be done on both sides. But having worked for a state for a goodly number of years, I think there's going to be some real challenges for states to figure out how to still be responsible stewards, but to stop being so prescriptive in how people should live their lives.
If you wanted to start an organization to provide the kind of person-centered supports we've been talking about, how would you go about doing that?
Well, I'd start talking with people. I'd start talking with a group of people who want supports. And I'd be talking locally with the people who have identified themselves as being interested in offering supports to people with developmental and intellectual disabilities. I think there are, once again, a reference earlier, I think there are a lot of people out there doing person-centered work, but they've never called it such. And I think the key is to get in local conversations. If I were in my own state, which I know the best, I know dozens of people out there in the community that I would, you know, they'd be on my my list to get in touch with and begin the process of talking. How can we find other people that, you know, would want to join a board of directors? How can we recruit the people that are, you know, going to be in support relationships and leaving the bulk of that decision to the people who are seeking supports? And there's a lot of different models you can follow. You know, you can be nonprofit, you can be a co-op, you can, you know, structure yourself in many different corporate guises to do that. But I think it's all finding those local people that already have the heart that beats with this rhythm. And you find those people and you bring them together. And a lot of the rest of it isn't magic. It's just rolling up your sleeves and getting there and doing the work and making sure you every day are always thinking about, how is this work consistent with the principles that we hold dear?
Well, thank you for taking a few minutes today to talk to us about your career and person-centered planning.
Sure thing, Donald. Happy to do it. Enjoyed the opportunity to chat with you. And I've always been a huge supporter of TASH, and I always will be. And I think TASH is a big player in the future of this, so I have a great deal of hope that TASH will engage, and as it always has, and be a major resource to people who believe there's still a lot of work to do here.
You've been listening to TASH Amplified. For more about the series, including show notes, links to articles discussed, a complete transcript, and a schedule of episodes updated as they become available, visit tash.org/amplified. You can have the series delivered automatically to your device by subscribing on iTunes. If you liked this episode, be sure to leave a rating for us there. You can also subscribe through your favorite Android app. To learn more about person-centered planning and what the Home and Community-Based Services Waiver Rule means for service provider agencies, you can listen to TASH's 7-part webinar series, Stepping Up to the Promise and Spirit of the Home and Community-Based Waiver, Person-Centered Planning, Thinking, and Doing, available through the TASH store. Episode 6 in the series, Truth-Telling, Bringing Consistency to the Practice of Supporting People, is a conversation between Lyle Rahmer and Jeff Strully on how to manage an agency in a way that embodies the principles of person-centered planning. TASH is a values and research-based advocacy association located in Washington, D.C., with local chapters covering 18 states. In 2015, we celebrated our 40th anniversary. We offer organization, advocacy, collaboration, scholarship, and education for people with disabilities, researchers, educators, service providers, and family members. In addition to this podcast series, we offer a scholarly quarterly, Research and Practice for Persons with Severe Disabilities, a popular magazine, Connections, a series of regional conferences, and our annual conference. You can learn more about TASH at tash.org. You can receive updates from TASH on this podcast and our other activities by following us on Facebook or on Twitter at TASHTweet. This has been a sample of the colleagues and conversations available through TASH. It is only because of the excellent work that our members do that we can bring you this information. For more resources such as this and to become a member, visit tash.org/join. We'll hear from another outstanding advocate again in 2 weeks.